Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming. My name is Jim Sniffen. I'm with the New York office of UNEP, the UN Environment Program. Today, our three distinguished panelists are here to brief you on a new report from UNEP and the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, entitled Assessment for Decision Makers, a Summary of the 2014 Scientific Assessment of Ozone Depletion. Our speakers today are Undersecretary General Achim Steiner, the Executive Director of UNEP, Dr. Paul Newman, the Chief Scientist for Atmospheres in the Earth Sciences Division at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. He's the co-chair of the Scientific Assessment Panel for the Montreal Protocol on Substances that Deplete the Ozone Layer. His fellow co-chair is Dr. A.R. Ravi Shankara, professor in the Departments of Chemistry and Atmospheric Science at Colorado State University and the former director of the Chemical Sciences Division of the Earth System Research Laboratory of the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, in Boulder, Colorado. And we'll begin with Mr. Steiner for an opening statement.
Thank you, Jim. Good afternoon. I was asked to introduce myself briefly for those who are not in the room. So Achim Steiner, Executive Director of the United Nations Environment Programme. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you today to perhaps one of the more significant scientific assessment reports that under the auspices of the United Nations we are contributing to the international policy discourse on both addressing changes in the atmosphere, the impact of ozone-depleting substances, but also very critical, just in a few days in advance of the Secretary-General's Summit on Climate Change, also linkages and implications for action on climate change. The work on ozone-depleting substances is perhaps one of the great success stories, not only of science informing policy, of nations beginning to act together on the basis of science by putting in place the Montreal Protocol, but also using the United Nations as a basis upon which technology, finance, capacity development has truly enabled us to succeed in objectives that many would have considered unachievable 20, 25 years ago. More than 98% of the ozone-depleting substances agreed over time have actually been phased down. Today we begin the presentation with the launch of the 2014 report of the scientific assessment of ozone depletion, and in particular the assessment for decision makers. It's a new byproduct, if I may call it that, or companion product to the assessment. Every 3 to 4 years, the world's leading scientists and experts in the field of ozone-depleting substances, atmospheric science, do come together under the auspices of the Montreal Protocol, and in particular under the auspices of the United Nations Environment Programme and our sister agency, the World Meteorological Organization. In a partnership that also brings WMO and UNEP together in hosting the IPCC, we have jointly provided the umbrella for bringing the science on ozone-depleting substances to the attention of the international community. What is particularly interesting in terms of the summary, but also of the assessments that are being produced this year, will in a moment be provided to you in more scientific language and detail by our very distinguished co-chairs who are here with us today. For many of you, it may be a little bit taxing because between CO2 and N2O and CH4 and HFCs and HCFCs, you may begin to wonder whether this is something you can adequately communicate to a broader public. So we will try to balance both the very substantive scientific body of evidence that underpins one of, as I called it, the great success stories of international collective action in addressing a global environmental change phenomenon, with also the implications for citizens across the planet who are beneficiaries of this success story. In principle, the main findings of the report state the following. The world avoided a major problem by getting rid of ozone-depleting substances via the Montreal Protocol. Indeed, without this protocol and all the actions that we have taken across the globe, we would be seeing a very substantial global ozone depletion today. We've seen evidence of a decline in ozone-depleting substances over the past decade. Now we're starting to see increasingly encouraging signs from ozone measurements that the ozone layer is on track to recovery by the middle of this century. And let this be also a reminder to all of us that if you have a problem of this magnitude, simply turning off the source of emission doesn't immediately begin to solve the problem. And there is a warning in here, I think, for all of us, that it sometimes can take a significant amount of time for vital support systems, life support systems on the planet to recover. We are only just now beginning to really trace the impact of the actions we have collectively taken over the last quarter of a century in actually allowing us to, well, envisage a recovery of the ozone layer by the middle of the century. The report and the main findings also point to the fact that we will, by the middle of the 21st century, see that changes in carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, and methane will also have an increasing influence on the ozone layer. So here is another reason why our work under the Montreal Protocol, the scientific assessments, remain extremely important, because as a collective community of nations and economies, we continue to add to complexity in addressing these environmental change phenomena. But perhaps the most important message that I would like to convey to you today has to do with our much clearer understanding that we're dealing here with a coupled and quite complex ozone layer and climate change issue. Between these two, there are connections in science, in human emissions that cause them, and hence also in the policy options for dealing with them. In very simple terms, you can say that ozone recovery is influenced by climate change, and you'll hear more about it in a moment. Ozone change has affected surface climate, as evident in the southern hemisphere. Getting rid of ozone-depleting substances has also been very good for climate. Indeed, some of the most extraordinary figures in terms of positive impact of actions in terms of carbon dioxide equivalent emissions avoided have actually been achieved almost inadvertently through the Montreal Protocol. Replacing ozone-depleting substances with high global warming potential HFCs could be very bad for climate, and this is a critical issue also with a view to the Secretary General's Climate Change Summit and a topic that is now part of the various areas of action that the SG has identified for progress on short-lived climate pollutants. But on the HFC issue in particular, we are at a critical point where HFCs were introduced in order to address the issue of ozone depletion. What we did not anticipate at the time, or what was not foreseen, is that if the use of HFCs continues to increase at the rate that we now envisage, which is roughly increasing at a rate of 7% a year, and you begin to extrapolate that, then by the year 2050, you could have a major negative issue and challenge in terms of global warming. And again, I think our two colleagues will in a moment speak to that. So we see significant potential to build on the extraordinary success story that the DNA, the design of the Montreal Protocol, has delivered in continuing to address the issue of ozone layer, but at the same time recognizing the significant potential, both in negative and positive terms, of trying to act on ozone-depleting substances and global warming or greenhouse gas drivers in terms of climate or global warming that would allow us to achieve win-win benefits. And this will be as much about policy politics as it is about science and technology becoming available. Thank you.
Thank you, Achim. Now we'll turn to Dr. Newman, who will provide us with a summary of the state and future of the ozone layer. Dr. Newman.
Thank you, Jim. My name is Paul Newman. I am one of the co-chairs for the scientific assessment panel to the Montreal Protocol, along with my colleague Dr. Ravi Shankara, two of our other co-chairs, Professor Pyle from the University of Cambridge, and Dr. Ayite Lo Ajivan could not join us today, but are also co-chairs. So it's a real pleasure to be talking here today for a couple of reasons. First of all, this work has been going, the drafting of this report and the ADM have been going on for more than a year now. It involves the direct writing, drafting of figures by about 200 scientists from around the world. So this is very much an international effort. The measurements involved thousands of scientists from around the world. So this is, I just have to say, this is a huge effort, and there are literally a couple of thousand scientists who deserve credit for this work. So we're going to talk about two primary issues in the ADM. The first thing we're going to talk about is that the changes in ozone-depleting substances They've been going down, and we now have the early hints that the ozone layer may be repairing itself. And then we'll talk about the emerging issue of hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs, and their connection to climate. So the first picture I'm going to show you are trends. These are decadal trends. And on the left side, you see a decadal trend. This is in the mid-latitudes as a function of altitude. This is on the left side is the 1979 to 1997 trends. And you can see that ozone was decreasing at a peak of about 7% per decade at an altitude of about 42 kilometers. If you look on the right side shows the trend at various altitudes, again in the northern mid-latitudes between the years 2000 and 2013. So the last 14 years or so. And you can see that at 42 kilometers now, the trend has reversed. The bars that you see going horizontally, that indicates the statistical significance of that trend. And so we would now say that ozone in the upper stratosphere is definitely increasing. In the lower altitudes, you can see that the bars cut across zero. There we cannot say we see a significant trend at this point.
Technology problem here.
This is on the screen, but not.
It's all there, but it seems to.
Not updating. Oh, there we go. So here I'm showing some of the model results. So these are models, coupled chemistry, climate models of the stratosphere. And you can see how closely these models actually match the observed values. These observations, by the way, that the thick black lines, they're derived from satellite and they're derived from ground measurements from a number of different sources. So you can see that the models are doing a pretty good job of representing what's happening in the stratosphere. The blue lines and the red lines on here represent the various contributions of ozone-depleting substances in red and climate gases, in particular carbon dioxide, methane, and N2O in blue. The ozone-depleting substances on the left side, you can see they caused a large depletion. Climate gases actually cause ozone to go up. So if you look at the right panel and you look up at 42 kilometers, you can see that ozone-depleting substances, because they're going down, ozone is going up. And because climate gases are increasing, ozone is also being driven up by the climate gases. So when we look at this graph, we know that ozone is increasing, but we cannot attribute it directly to just the Montreal Protocol. It's happening because of both climate gases and because of the decrease of ozone-depleting substances. Now, I remarked that initially that levels of ozone-depleting substances were rapidly rising in the 1979 to 1987. The top figure shows a quantity we call equivalent effective stratospheric chlorine. And this is a way of estimating chlorine in the stratosphere. We combine both chlorine and bromine. Bromine is a very efficient atom for destroying ozone, and so we add it into the chlorine to come up with this EESC. Just think of it as the level of compounds in the stratosphere that can lead to ozone destruction. On the bottom, you can see the blue is actual observations. And again, these observations are derived from satellites. They're confirmed with ground observations. A huge effort has gone into deriving that blue line down below. If we advance a few years, we know that the Antarctic ozone hole was developing during this time. Ozone was declining fairly fast over Antarctica. The Montreal Protocol was signed in 1987. And by the year 2000, we could see that actually ozone-depleting substances had stopped going up. So that was the first evidence that the Montreal Protocol was working. We were no longer seeing ozone-depleting substances increasing. You could see that the actual ozone levels were still going down. At that time, there was a little uptick. That was due to Mount Pinatubo, though. And that, oops. By the year 2013, now you can see that ozone depleting substances were strongly on the decline. This is about a 10 to 15% decline from the 1980 levels. If you look down in the graph below where the observations is, it looks like ozone was on a gentle upswing. The ozone hole is still very much with us. And the question now is whether these total ozone observations, 60 south to 60 north, is pretty much a global average, whether this indicated that, in fact, in total column ozone, we were seeing recovery. And the answer to that is we're not certain about that. There's uncertainties in the data. There's confounding effects from things like volcanoes and so forth. So we cannot say that the blue line, although it hints at it, that this is not good evidence for that the ozone, the total ozone, is recovering. And over Antarctica, we still see very large Antarctic ozone holes. So the bottom line is that while we see ozone depleting substances going down and we can see some improvement at 42 kilometer altitude, we are not seeing it in the column yet. So just to add one other thing here, this shows our projections for EESC, that is ozone depleting substances in the stratosphere. On top of that, there are model projections. The model projections show that we ought to return to a 1980 level in the year, about the year 2030 or so. Hesitating a little bit. And then to make one final point here about model projections. These model projections are very sensitive to the projections of greenhouse gases in the future. So the four colored lines you see on the graph here represent four different future scenarios for greenhouse gases, different levels of CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide. And in fact, you can see there's quite a bit of scatter in these graphs. So because we're uncertain about where greenhouse gases are going in the future, there's some uncertainty about where total ozone is going to go in the future. And with that, let me turn it over to Dr. Ravi Shankara.
Thank you. My name is Ravi Shankara. Paul has explained to you the role played by climate gases on the stratospheric ozone. There's also a flip side to that. And that is, the ozone layer changes have also influenced climate, and it's most clearly visible in the southern hemisphere. I'm not going to talk about that right now, but I'm going to focus on a slightly different part, and that is, the ozone-depleting substances are like this Janus. It has two faces. One, it depletes the ozone layer, but at the same time, they're also very potent greenhouse gases. So these ozone-depleting substances affect stratospheric ozone and climate. And of course, as Paul just pointed out, climate change affects stratospheric ozone. And I just pointed out, again, the stratospheric ozone changes affect climate. So it's a reasonably complex system. But let's focus simply on a very simple idea, and that is, what Montreal Protocol avoided for climate? Essentially, because Montreal Protocol prevented the buildup of ozone-depleting substances, and in fact, now it's going down, it actually helped climate. The simplest way you can look at it is if you were to look at this little bar that I show here as what we would have achieved during the first commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol. What Montreal Protocol did is roughly five times that for the same period. In other words, as a byproduct of the Montreal Protocol, we helped climate significantly. Now, the thing that happened, of course, was the ozone-depleting substances as a continuation of this little background is CFCs were being produced and they're being reduced. In fact, the production has gone down almost to zero. In place of CFCs, we introduced a new set of chemicals called hydrochlorofluorocarbons that were not as bad for the ozone layer, but at the same time, they could work in the devices and things like that to ease the transition out of the ozone-depleting substances. And now there are more and more use of these next-generation compounds called hydrofluorocarbons, which do not contain chlorine or bromine, so they do not destroy the ozone layer. So the key point is HFCs do not destroy the ozone layer, so they're good for climate. But because of that, their use has continued to increase. And you can see on the right-hand side the use of these in various sectors. And as you can see, in 1990, it was essentially zero. And now it has gone up by a significant amount. So the HFCs are increasing in production and in terms of usage. And you can actually see this in the atmosphere. What this shows in the top picture is the abundance of HFC-134a, which is probably, in fact, I can guarantee you, that is the air conditioner that you all use today in coming here in your cars. That's what is used, assuming you have an air conditioner. There's another compound called HFC-23, which is a byproduct of the production of HCFC-22. All of them are increasing very rapidly. And if you can convert these atmospheric concentrations to how much is being emitted, as you can see, it's going up very, very rapidly. And Mr. Steiner just pointed out, is increasing at the rate of about 7% per year right now. So then if you were to ask the question, what is the impact of this on climate, the metric we are using here is called radiative forcing. Anything that's positive warms, so it's a greenhouse gas. If you were to look from 1980 on, CFCs and HCFCs were going up until about 1990s. And then since then, it has been pretty constant. There's the top curve. And then underneath it are a few other lines of what's happening with HFCs. And of course, because of the Montreal Protocol, CFCs and HCFCs are going to keep going down. But at the same time, as you can see, HFCs are going to keep going up. So some of the calculations suggest, depending on the scenario you use, that HFCs could be contributing emissions from now until 2050, as much as 25% of the CO2 emissions from now until 2050. The other way of looking at it is, if you do something about CO2 to stabilize at 450 parts per million target, if you continue to emit HFCs, it could easily offset all the work you have done in trying to reduce CO2. Okay, but there's a good news to this. It doesn't have to be that way. There are alternatives to these kinds of highly potent greenhouse HFCs. And if you use different levels of this GWPH, global warming potential, HFCs, in fact, you could keep the contributions of HFCs down to roughly 1%, which is what it is right now. So actions taken today could avoid buildup of HFCs. And it also appears such alternatives, both in terms of the chemicals and technology, are available. So with that, let me just kind of tell you again what we just told you. We just highlighted two of the key findings from our assessment. One is the changes in the ozone-depleting substances and the ozone layer, and what happens in the future for the ozone layer. And the second thing I mentioned is the role of HFCs, which has come about because of the Montreal Protocol to a first approximation and its connection to climate change. There's a lot more details in the executive summary and also in the document you probably all got called the Assessment for Decision Makers, which has a lot more information. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Ravishankara. Now we'll turn it over to questions. If you could identify yourself for the benefit of the panelists. First question.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Valeria Robecco for ANSA News Web Service, and I welcome you on behalf of UN Correspondent Association, and I thank you for this important briefing. My question is, which is the major threat on the track to recovery, and what are the most urgent measures to take to avoid this threat? Thank you.
I'll mention in terms of the climate aspect of it. For ozone layer, ozone depletion, we have done quite a bit, and it's continued to be a success as long as we continue to adhere to the Montreal Protocol. The second part is CO2 is the 800-pound gorilla in terms of climate change, but there are substantial and significant contributions that could be from HFCs. I stop at that, and that's what the science says. And I'll turn to Mrs. Steiner or Paul to add anything more.
Yeah. There is one aspect that we touch on in the ADM that we didn't bring out in our graphs today, and that is that while global ozone, as long as the parties to the Montreal Protocol adhere to its control measures, ozone will recover globally, and the Antarctic ozone hole and Arctic ozone depletions will go away. On the other hand, in the tropics, there will be climate gases are projected to cause ozone to decline in the tropics. And so that is, I would say, a minor threat because it won't be massive depletion from climate gases. But nevertheless, ozone will go down a bit because of climate gases. And there are figures in the ADM that actually show those projections. Okay.
Perhaps just to put a little bit more broad context to it, what was originally a drama, if you want to take the analogy, written in three acts, is actually beginning to unfold into a more continuous drama of the 21st century, which is the collective footprint of 7, 8, 9, soon 10 billion people on some of the vital life support systems on the planet. I say in three acts because initially it was the science on the ozone depletion and ozone depleting substances that was the first step. Then the establishment of a protocol was the second step to bring nations around the table and agree on how to address this. And at the end of the day, the deployment of technology and alternative substances for industry allowed us to begin to address the phenomenon of this ozone hole. Now, I say the drama has suddenly turned into a 4- or 5-act drama because as we acted on one issue, we are beginning to see that we are succeeding, but we have actually created for ourselves another problem, which is the link to climate change. And at the time of the Montreal Protocol, global warming, carbon dioxide emissions, and also greenhouse gases were not the focus of our international attention. Science has given us a far greater understanding now that not only do we have to address the ozone-depleting substances, global warming, carbon dioxide, but indeed, as chemistry allows us to deploy new substances, we now have this challenge that by solving one problem, we amplify another one, HFCs. And I think the great message is that if we act now in understanding the connection between ozone and climate action, we can avoid a major problem. Do we not succeed in having a mutually reinforcing and compatible strategy, we will actually undermine, ironically, the efforts in one international effort called the UNFCCC by inadvertent impacts under the Montreal Protocol, and that is why this issue has become so significant. Now, a key drama or a key component in drama is always the ingredients of what drive the process, and in this case, it has a lot to do with technology, with who controls technology or who owns technology, and how we can make the transition through a very successful instrument like the Montreal Protocol, in which we have the multilateral fund, precisely to help countries access technology become a way forward and not a reason not to act on what is incontrovertible science that is available to us now. So it's a fascinating drama in multiple acts, yeah.
Thanks. Sure. Can you identify yourself? And we need to be a bit brief because we have a 3 o'clock briefing coming in after us. Yeah.
Okay. Sure, I'll be brief. Brendan Pastor for South-South News. Thank you for the briefing. And if it's okay, I would wonder if I could ask you to apply your very brilliant scientific minds to more of the policy prescriptions for this. My understanding of the Montreal Protocol was that it was in many ways it released a lot of market-based instruments so that it wasn't purely government regulations that were, you know, demanding big changes in industry, but rather they were industries themselves adapting to the changes. But if my understanding is correct, there were additional externalities of the Montreal Protocol, as you say, which are have the potential to offset any, you know, hopefully future changes in carbon emissions. Do you think or do you see similar instruments being employed going forward, market-based instruments, or is this the kind of thing where there will be need to be additional resources, additional untapped methods for addressing all types of gases in the atmosphere? Thank you.
Well, one of the very simple first responses to is the Montreal Protocol has proven itself to be so successful because it also evolves with the availability of technology and science, and therefore also the opportunity for actors in the marketplace to introduce innovation and new products. I think what is critical to the ability to act on this is that as science gives us more precision, what the Montreal Protocol has very often succeeded in doing is to take the science related to available technologies and through the multilateral fund look at opportunities in which you can enable a market also under the principle of access to technology be effective. And I think this is where right now we are confronted with a challenge that, for instance, in looking for alternatives to HFCs, there are indeed already scientifically and technologically available alternatives, but not in an open market sense. They are in part intellectual property, and they do not yet respond to all questions that, for instance, particularly countries with extremely hot climates have when it comes to air conditioning and other aspects. So I think the beauty of what we have seen through the Montreal Protocol, what you're alluding to, is that we're able to use a regulatory framework to allow science to become a market-compatible deployment strategy. And that is precisely why we need governments to take an initiative in order for markets and industries to be able to respond to this science.
Thanks. Another question?
Gentlemen, do you want to take a science perspective, always
I'll
safer?
I have a very quick response about the CO2. Yes, indeed, it reached 400 parts per million, which is a record. And it was as much a record as when it was 390. It keeps going up. So it continues to grow. That's the only thing that I can tell you about from a science perspective. Paul, you want to add something?
Yeah, the only thing I will add is that we do include CO2 in our modeling of the stratosphere, and it's part of the recovery that we are seeing in the upper stratospheres. We cool the upper stratosphere, and we enable ozone to increase faster. And, of course, so this is within the scenarios that we see. We have a range of scenarios going into the future. We just don't know where that is. So we don't know what the trajectory ends with in the 21st century. Malcolm?
Very briefly, the Secretary General's invitation to heads of state and government to address themselves to the issue of climate change 1 year in advance of what is another key milestone in the evolution of the UNFCCC is precisely to make climate change once more an issue that is dealt with at the highest level of government. That is, in many ways, what the Secretary General is trying to achieve with his summit in a few weeks' time. And what you have heard here today is part of a whole array of areas in which governments, industry, communities, societies can actually act right now on addressing this issue, are in fact acting on it. And here I would simply say to those who, you know, always refer to the UN failing to achieve action or progress on the issue of climate change, I would very much caution people to judge the impact of the United Nations and enabling through the United Nations the scientific community to inform the world of governments, of industry, and of policy, to judge the impact only by, in a sense, signed outcomes and signed protocols. The fact of the matter is that as a result of having given life to the IPCC and therefore having established an independent forum for scientists around climate change to speak to the world about what was happening by providing the world with a framework convention within which governments could, over the next 20, 25 years, reinvent their economies for the 21st century, has had a tremendous impact. The world is talking about climate change today, not as something that we began with in Nairobi 25 years ago in a conference room with scientists trying to persuade the world that carbon dioxide mattered. We are talking about reinventing our energy sectors, transport sectors, building sectors, our economic policies, dependencies on fossil fuels. In less than a quarter of a century, we have succeeded through the multilateral system with the extraordinarily important work of science to influence the outlook of virtually every sector of our economy and of virtually every country on this planet about their future over just the next 50 to 100 years. So even if we struggle right now to codify all this in a legally binding agreement, do not underestimate the impact that all this work has already had on the world. And however difficult the task is, the Secretary General is once again stepping outside the comfort zone of those who will wait for others to lead and is inviting the world's leaders to take that same responsibility. Some will follow his invitation. Many may still wait. So let us also look at the September summit as an opportunity to see who are the leaders in our international community who can provide inspiration but also responsible leadership on addressing what is an extremely challenging phenomenon.
We have time for one more question.
My name is Emma Kebabiak. I'm with the German Press Agency. And talking about these alternatives to HFCs, if they were to be implemented and used, does it mean that simply the level's not going to get any worse and it's not going to do any more damage to the climate? Or might there be an unintended consequence, just the same with the getting rid of the ozone-depleting substances, of actually making things better for the climate? Thank you.
Take a first shot at it. It's not going to get better right away because CFCs and HCFCs have to go down in terms of that contribution. But the contribution of HFCs themselves would be very small, negligibly small, actually. There could be other issues related to which exact chemical you would use, but those are being researched, and all the signs are that there are alternatives to doing that, this substitution, so that you don't have to use those potent greenhouse gases.
Thank you. Paul, you have anything to add?
No.
Yeah. Dr. Steiner will make a brief concluding remark, and then we'll wrap up. Thanks.
Thank you very much for your interest. As I said at the beginning, this is in some ways a complex topic, but I hope you can convey to the world that here is a great example of why sometimes acting collectively internationally under the auspices of the United Nations produces extraordinary benefits for humanity. And I would just like to say that as part of this assessment process, there are also other panels that are working at the moment and have contributed to the assessment, a techno-economic assessment panel and also an environmental effects assessment panel. And interesting enough, under the environmental effects, the Montreal Protocol may already be preventing somewhere around 2 million cases of skin cancer each year. And by the end of this first century of the Montreal Protocol, it could be as high as 100 million cases of skin cancer that have been avoided. I mean, this is just to make a connection to why does this matter to me? And you can always read up why an ozone hole actually is not just a hole somewhere up there. It is something with grave consequences for human well-being and for the well-being of our planet. What we try to present to you today in a very quick and abbreviated form is, if you want, a journey of success, of challenge and hope. Success in terms of the protocol, challenge in terms of maintaining the world's attention and commitment to continuing to focus on this phenomenon of ozone-depleting substances and the ozone layer, and also a message of hope that actually, if we can combine these instruments, if we can persuade that acting on climate and ozone-depleting substances is a win-win proposition that is of interest to nations individually and of humanity collectively, then there is a tremendous scope for achieving further breakthroughs with this instrument. So thank you for your attention. Information on websites and all this is in the press release, isn't it?
Yeah. Thank you, Jim. Thank you for coming. You. There's material in the back of the room in 6 languages, at least the press release, including the presentation by Dr. Newman and Dr. Ravishankara. And if you don't find anything, you can always email me and I'll provide it to you electronically. Thanks for coming.